From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I know of no cases where people were deliberately targeted by the use of white phosphorus.
Pentagon spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan last week on Democracy Now! This week, Pentagon spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable reverses the military's position.
It was used as an incendiary weapon against enemy combatants.
Did the U.S. military use chemical weapons in Fallujah? Then the Senate passes what they call a compromise that still could strip Guantanamo detainees of any trial.
In 2004, the Center for Constitutional Rights won the right of every Guantanamo detainee to file a writ of habeas corpus. A few days ago, the Senate, in a rump sort of session, attempted to undercut and wipe out the right of habeas corpus.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Amid mounting Democratic criticism of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, President Bush and Vice President Cheney have made their strongest responses yet to accusations they misled the country into war. At a news conference in South Korea, Bush said, quote, "I expect there to be criticism, but when Democrats say I deliberately misled the Congress and the people, that's irresponsible." Meanwhile, Cheney told a Washington gathering of the Frontiers of Freedom Institute, quote, "The suggestion that's been made by some U.S. senators that the President of the United States or any member of this administration purposely misled the American people on pre-war intelligence is one of the most dishonest and reprehensible charges ever aired in this city. What we're hearing now is some politicians contradicting their own statements and making a play for political advantage in the middle of a war," Cheney said. In response, last year's Democratic presidential hopeful Senator John Kerry said it was difficult to name a government official with less credibility on Iraq than Vice President Cheney. Weekly Standard editor and Bush administration insider William Kristol commented, quote, "If the American people really come to a settled belief that Bush lied us into war, his presidency will be over." Meanwhile, President Bush has rebuffed a North Korean demand to be supplied a light water nuclear reactor before it disarms. In talks held in September, North Korea agreed to dismantle its nuclear program in exchange for energy assistance and security recognition, but reversed the decision a day later. Bush is in South Korea for the APEC summit, which begins Friday. On Capitol Hill, House and Senate negotiators have reached a tentative agreement towards the renewal of the USA Patriot Act. Under the agreement, the federal government would retain several controversial powers, including the right to access library and bookstore records. The Washington Post observes the agreement, quote, "sides with a stronger government hand when terrorism investigation clash with civil liberties concerns." 14 provisions set to expire at year's end will be made permanent. Another three measures, including the one allowing access to library and bookstore records, will be extended for 7 years. Outcries growing in several European and North African countries over the use of local airports for renditions of CIA detainees. Government officials and newspapers in countries including Norway, Sweden, Morocco, and Spain have raised concerns over specific incidents of CIA flights in their respective territory. The Spanish newspaper El País cited a Civil Guard report saying CIA planes made at least 10 secret stopovers in the Balearic Islands last year. Meanwhile, an Italian prosecutor demanded the extradition of 23 CIA agents believed to have been involved in the abduction of Osama Mustafa Hassan Nasser. Nasser was kidnapped by CIA agents in Milan and brought to Egypt for interrogation in February 2003. USA Today is reporting U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan are encountering the fiercest fighting they've seen since the launch of the U.S. invasion in 2001. 87 troops have been killed this year so far, nearly half the total killed since the war began. The fighting's calling into question plans to phase out the 18,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan with NATO-led forces. On Wednesday, Afghanistan's defense minister told the Associated Press, "Insurgent attacks have begun to resemble tactics seen in Iraq. Three suicide bombings hit the capital of Kabul this week, killing 10 people, including a U.S. soldier." The New York Times is reporting an American businessman has been charged with paying bribes and kickbacks to American occupation authorities in return for reconstruction contracts in Iraq. Philip Bloom, who received up to $3.5 million in contracts, has been charged with conspiracy, wire fraud, money laundering, and transportation of stolen property. The indictment also includes two officials with the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S.-controlled body that ruled the country until June 2004. Indictments are expected in several other investigations of U.S. officials and contractors. A spokesperson for the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction said, quote, "This is the first case, but it won't be the last." In Haiti, the interim government has postponed presidential and legislative elections for a third time. Voting had most recently been scheduled for the week of December 11th. The government now says elections will be held December 27th. Critics blasted the new date for falling 2 days after Christmas, when many Haitians will be visiting family away from their voting districts. The interim regime is under intense pressure from the U.S. and French governments to have a new government in place by February 7th, the date specified by Haiti's constitution. Haiti's holding its first election since the overthrow of the democratically elected president Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February of 2004. The Federal Election Commission will investigate a conservative organization's complaint against hip-hop mogul Sean Combs, also known as Diddy. The National Legal Policy Center alleges Combs violated federal electoral and revenue laws by using a voter registration drive to promote the election of John Kerry in last year's presidential elections. Combs helped found the group Citizen Change, which held a widely publicized campaign to enlist young voters. The group cited instances where speakers made anti-Bush comments at Citizen Change events. Internal documents show the chemical company DuPont hid studies documenting the risks of a Teflon-related chemical used in the manufacture of hundreds of different types of food containers. The study said the chemical, Zonal, can rub off packaging and contaminate food with a potentially carcinogenic compound known as PFOA. A former DuPont chemical engineer backed the claim the company hid the studies. Referring to the chemicals, Glenn Evers told reporters, quote, "They're toxic. They get into human blood. And they're also in every one of you, your loved ones, your fellow citizens." DuPont is denying the allegations. The Environmental Protection Agency has been investigating whether DuPont has withheld information on potentially dangerous chemicals. The FBI has reached a settlement with an environmental activist wrongly jailed for committing arson attacks against SUV dealerships in California's San Gabriel Valley. Josh Canola spent 4 nights in jail for the attacks, which destroyed over 125 vehicles. He'll receive $100,000 in compensation. He told the Associated Press Monday he hopes his victory will show that, quote, "You can't throw people's civil rights out the window in the name of fighting terrorism." In media news, Tribune Company has announced it'll cut jobs at 5 of its newspapers. The cuts will include elimination of 85 newsroom employees at the Los Angeles Times, about 8% of its editorial staff. Earlier this week, Los Angeles Times announced a reshuffling of its op-ed pages that included the dismissal of longtime progressive columnist Robert Scheer. Tribune has already announced job cuts at several other newspapers, including the Baltimore Sun, the San Jose Mercury News, and Newsday. And newly released documents from the National Archive provide fresh insight into the Nixon administration's efforts to deceive the public over its 1970 attack on Cambodia. Over 50,000 pages of declassified material include records of then-President Richard Nixon's meeting with aides at a time Americans were told U.S. forces in Cambodia were there to support South Vietnamese. Nixon told aides, quote, "That is what we will say publicly, but now let's talk about what we actually do." Nixon instructed staff to continue the bombing of Cambodia and Vietnam. He also ordered them to extend the attacks to Laos, which had remained neutral. Nixon said, quote, "I want you to put the air in there and not spare the horses. Do not withdraw for domestic reasons, but only for military reasons." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. The U.S. government has now admitted its troops used white phosphorus as an incendiary weapon against Iraqis during the assault on Fallujah a year ago. Chemical weapons experts say such attacks are in violation of international law banning the use of chemical weapons. Peter Kaiser of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said, quote, chemicals used against humans or animals that cause harm or death through the toxic properties of the chemical are considered chemical weapons. White phosphorus is often compared to napalm because it combusts spontaneously when exposed to oxygen and can burn right through skin to the bone.
The Pentagon's admission comes after a week of denials that it used white phosphorus as a weapon in Fallujah. While reporters have noted the use of white phosphorus since the war began, it only became a major story last Tuesday when Italian state broadcaster Rai TV aired the documentary Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre. On that same day, Democracy Now! Aired an excerpt of the documentary here in the United States and interviewed Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan, the director of the Pentagon's Combined Press Information Center in Baghdad. During our broadcast, Boylan denied the claims made in the documentary that white phosphorus was used as a weapon to target Iraqis.
I know of no cases where people were deliberately targeted by the use of white phosphorus. Again, I did not say white phosphorus was used for illumination. White phosphorus is used for obscuration, which white phosphorus produces a heavy, thick smoke to shield us or them from view so that they cannot see what we're doing. It is used to destroy equipment, to destroy buildings. That is what white phosphorus shells are used for.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan speaking on Democracy Now! Last Tuesday, but the Pentagon was caught in a lie after it was revealed that an official Army publication called Field Artillery Magazine had disclosed the Army had in fact used white phosphorus as a weapon. The magazine in its March-April issue reported, quote, white phosphorus proved to be an effective and versatile munition and a potent psychological weapon against the insurgents in trench lines and spider holes. The magazine went on to report, quote, we fired shake-and-bake missions at the insurgents using WP, white phosphorus, to flush them out, and HE, high explosives, to take them out. On Tuesday, Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable, another Pentagon spokesperson, admitted on the BBC that white phosphorus was used as an offensive weapon to target insurgents.
White phosphorus is a conventional munition. It's not a chemical weapon. They are not outlawed or illegal. We use them primarily as obscurants for smoke screens or for target marking in some cases. However, it is an incendiary weapon and may be used against enemy combatants.
Can you confirm then that it was used as an offensive weapon against enemy troops during the siege of Fallujah?
Yes. It was used as an incendiary weapon against enemy combatants.
There are suggestions here that if used in that way, an incendiary weapon such as white phosphorus would be against the various conventions governing the use of weapons during war. You disagree?
Cite the conventions.
The Chemical Weapons Convention.
Okay. Does it list white phosphorus as a chemical?
No, it doesn't, but it says a chemical weapon can be any chemical which through its chemical action on life processes can cause death, temporary incapacitation, or permanent harm.
But this is we're talking white phosphorus is an incendiary weapon, not a chemical weapon.
That was Pentagon spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable being interviewed on the BBC. The Pentagon has defended its use of white phosphorus by claiming it's not a chemical weapon and that it was only used against Iraqi insurgents, not civilians. However, even this would have been illegal according to the Army's own rules of combat. In 1999, the Army published a handbook that read, quote, it's against the law of land warfare to employ WP against personnel targets. An Iraqi human rights team has reportedly gone into Fallujah to investigate the use of white phosphorus as a weapon by U.S. forces. To discuss this controversy, we're joined by two guests. On the phone from Italy, Maurizio Torrialta. He's news editor for the Italian state broadcaster Rai, co-producer of the documentary Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre. We're also joined from Britain by George Monbiot, a columnist for The Guardian of London. On Tuesday, he published an article entitled The U.S. Used Chemical Weapons in Iraq and Then Lied About It. We first go to Maurizio Torrialta. You did the documentary. Your response to the new statement of the Pentagon, following up on the Pentagon's denial when you were on the broadcast last week, saying they didn't use they didn't use white phosphorus as a weapon against people in Fallujah.
Well, first of all, I want to say that any time any institution correct itself, I think, is a great event. And I would like to see many more institutions that are able to admit their mistakes. Then the correction is not complete, because the Pentagon said that they use white phosphorus as a weapon, but not on civilian. And unfortunately, we got really hundreds of pictures of people that seems to be killed by white phosphorus. And I think an investigation, a United Nations investigation on that, could really finally say the last word about how much has been used against civilian people. And then there is another couple of questions that I have in my mind. First of all, these news are not something that was unknown. The Independent, The Guardian wrote about the use of white phosphorus, and a lot of Arabian website was they published information about that. And what make that became a news right now? There's a question that I really can't answer, and I think I should be, we should discuss a little bit about this second question.
George Monbiot, I'd like to ask you, the Pentagon is trying to split hairs in terms of how it defines chemical weapons. Your perspective on their attempt to get through their own contradictions on this?
Right. The Chemical Weapons Convention could not be clearer. There are two kinds of chemicals listed under it. One is the scheduled chemicals, such as phosgene and mustard gas and VX gas, which cannot be used under any circumstances. Then there is all other toxic chemicals, which may be used for purposes which do not depend on the use of their toxic properties. However, the moment you use one of those other chemicals for its toxic properties against human beings, you are in breach of the convention. And what we saw very clearly from that extract in Field Artillery magazine was that they were firing these munitions directly at the combatants in Fallujah in order to exert the toxic effects of those munitions upon those combatants to flush them out so they could then be killed. In doing so, the U.S. Army was acting in direct contravention of the Chemical Weapons Convention. It committed a war crime.
I wanted to play an excerpt from the Rai TV documentary Massacre, the Hidden, Fallujah, the Hidden Massacre. This part features an interview with Mohammed Tarek al-Daraji, a biologist from Fallujah who heads the Fallujah Center for Human Rights.
Mohammed opens his PC and shows us images of a victim in Fallujah, a woman lying on the side, clothes intact, hiding a scorched body, a veil covering like a shroud, a face melted by the heat.
In al-Askari, I hear some witnesses say, here's somebody is killing by the unknown type from the weapons.
In what state did you find the dead?
Different type. Children, women, younger, youth, older man. All different from the people. But many from them, he is killing on the bed, inside the chicken room or cooking room. Some from them, when he prior, there is some witnesses. He say, when American attack some places, the big, what's the name of the bab or the alwan? Sean?
The shower of fire?
Yeah, shower, but the different color.
Strange
color. And after this, there is... all the people in this place is died.
Why was the bombing so severe?
In the April battle, American say we want to catch the bugle killing the four counters, American counters. After the battle in April, American, he cannot to enter the city, but he researched about another reason. He found maybe that terrorist is a suitable reason. He continues to attack Fallujah between the April and the November. More 100 houses destroyed to kill Zarqawi and the assistant of Zarqawi.
That is Mohammed Tariq al-Daraji, a biologist from Fallujah, quoted in the documentary Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre. We'll get response when we come back. And I should also say we did call the Pentagon. We called Lieutenant Colonel Venable and asked him to join us, who had stated the reversal of the military position on whether they used white phosphorus as a weapon against people in Fallujah. He was extremely angry, and he refused to come on the broadcast. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 400 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM, college community stations around the country, and public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the so-called Senate compromise on the issue of whether detainees at Guantanamo have access to trial and the issue of habeas corpus. We'll be speaking with a lawyer from the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, as well as Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. But now we're on the line with George Monbiot, author and columnist for The Guardian of London, wrote the piece U.S. Lied About Chemical Weapons in Iraq, and Maurizio Torrialta, news editor for the Italian television Rai, co-producer of the film Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre. We just saw this biologist from Fallujah speaking. Maurizio Torrialta, could you amplify on who he was and what he saw?
Yes, he's a member of the human rights organization in Fallujah.
And he tried a couple of times to brought it to the attention of Western people what happened in Fallujah. He visited Rome, and then he went to Strasbourg at the European Parliament, invited by organizations, some political organizations, and some European deputies. And we met him there, and he told us some information. But what struck me is the fact that it's been a year that he was speaking about such a thing. And just the recent day, I got a lot of letters that has been sent by organization in Fallujah to the UN, to Kofi Annan, denouncing the same thing, and nothing happened. And we had to put on video some horrible pictures in order to have some kind of a reaction. And the reaction came before from the society. The politician didn't really care less. So finally, it broke through. I mean, it became a news. And after a year, people knows what happened, knows at least has some idea of what happened in Fallujah. And I'm really, as a journalist, I'm really scared by the impossibility that the people in Fallujah had for years to brought to the attention of all the media what really happened over there.
George Monbiot, your column also mentions that the field artillery article was not the first mention of the use of white phosphorus, that there was actually some reporting by an embedded reporter at the North County Times in Southern California as early as April 2004. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I'll quote you from what he said. He was an embedded reporter with the Marines during the siege of Fallujah, which, as you say, took place in April 2004. And his article goes as follows. "Gun up," Millican yelled, grabbing a white phosphorus round from a nearby ammo can and holding it over the tube. "Fire," Bogert yelled as Millican dropped it. The boom kicked dust around the pit as they ran through the drill again and again, sending a mixture of burning white phosphorus and high explosives they call shake and bake into a cluster of buildings where insurgents have been spotted all week. Now, the key term there is into a cluster of buildings. In other words, again, they were not using this white phosphorus for the purposes of illumination or for the purposes of smoke screening, both of which are legal uses of white phosphorus in war. They were using it as a weapon in order to flush the insurgents out of those buildings. Doing so is in breach of the Chemical Weapons Convention.
And in both that article and in the field artillery, they keep referring to this mixture called shake and bake, which is obviously a mixture of white phosphorus and explosives at the same time. So it's clearly meant to be used as an offensive weapon, no?
I believe it's a pun on some seasoning which you have in the United States, which you put on a chicken before you put it in the oven. The idea is that you shake them out of their hiding place, and then you can bake them or kill them with high explosives, having shaken them out with your white phosphorus. The use of white phosphorus to do that is not legal.
I wanted to go back to the documentary, Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre, which is the documentary that Rai Television, the Italian state broadcaster, did last week, that Democracy Now! Also broadcast. BBC then got this reversal from the military on whether they used white phosphorus as a weapon against people in Fallujah. And this goes to the testimony of Italian journalist Giuliana Screna, who worked as a reporter in Iraq before she was kidnapped. She spoke to Rai TV after she was released.
Not only in Fallujah. I had heard stories from the inhabitants about the use of certain weapons, like napalm, in Baghdad during the battle at the airport in April 2003. And then I had collected, just before going to interview the city refugees, testimonies from other inhabitants of Fallujah about the use of guns on white phosphorus. In particular, some women had tried to enter their homes and they had found a certain dust spread all over the house. The Americans themselves had told them to clean their houses with detergents because that dust was very dangerous. In fact, they had some effects on their bodies, bleedings and very strange things. I would have liked to interview those persons, but unfortunately my kidnappers, who said to be part of Fallujah's resistance, have forbidden me to tell what I have known about Fallujah by kidnapping me. This war cannot have witnesses. It cannot have witnesses because it's based on lies. The Americans have permitted only to embedded journalists to go to Fallujah. Despite that...
That was Juliana Segrena. And now Jeff Engelhardt, who is a former U.S. soldier.
Were any chemical weapons used in Fallujah?
From the U.S. military. Yeah, absolutely. White phosphorus. Possibly napalm. May or may not have been used, I don't know. I do know that white phosphorus was used, which is definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, a chemical weapon.
Is he sure of it?
Yes, it happened.
How can he be certain?
Well, it comes across the radio as a general transmission. When it happens like that, you hear it on the radio through, we have speakers in our trucks. The speakers, and then the transmission goes to the speakers, so it's audible. And as they say, in 5 mics, we're going to drop some whiskey peep. Roger, commence bombing. I mean, it just comes across the radio, and like when you hear whiskey peep, that's the military slang.
Contrary to what was said by the U.S. State Department, white phosphorus was not used on the open field to illuminate enemy troops. For this, tracer was used. A rain of fire shot from U.S. helicopters on the city of Fallujah on the night of the 8th of November. That we will show you in this exceptional documentary, which proves that a chemical agent was used in a massive and indiscriminate way in districts of Fallujah. In the days that followed, U.S. satellite images showed Fallujah burnt out and razed to the ground.
The gases from the warhead, the white phosphorus, will disperse in a cloud. And when it makes contact with skin, then it's absolutely irreversible damage, burning flesh to the bone. It doesn't necessarily burn clothes, but it will burn the skin underneath clothes. And this is why protective masks do not help, because it will burn right through the mask, the rubber of the mask. It will manage to get inside your face. If you breathe it, it will blister your throat and your lungs till you suffocate, and then it will burn you from the inside. It basically reacts to skin, oxygen, and water. The only way to stop the burning is with wet mud, but at that point, it's just impossible to stop.
Have you seen the effects of these weapons?
Yes. Burned bodies. I mean, and burned children and burned women. White phosphorus kills indiscriminately. It's a cloud that will, within most cases, 150 meters of impact, will disperse, and it will burn every human being or animal.
That was Jeff Engelhardt, who is a former U.S. soldier, speaking from Colorado. As we wrap up, Maurizio Torrealta of Rai, where he is being broadcast, the documentary Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre. The response in Italy, not to mention the rest of the world, to this documentary.
Yeah, the response in Italy is bizarre, because when we broadcast it, we had one day before having some response, because then we had 2 days of strike, the newspaper running strike. So there were a few newspapers that wrote about, and then there was a silence for 2 days. And then again, there was nothing for 3 or 4 days. And paradoxically, now, yesterday and the day before, it was the first news on the first page. Why? Because it came from outside. At that point, the news has been bounced in the United States, in England, and it became some information transformed themselves in news. And now is the news. And now, yesterday, was in the major news break of the major channel of the Italian television. So it's been a strange, very strange percours. The news really has been diffused, but didn't have the reaction right now. It seems like there are two different media that are fighting. One media, which is based on the internet, which is based on the net and on the streaming, and has a different way to spread around. And the other media, the mainstream media, which is very slow, very much controlled, and does come out right away with information, only after it became something bigger. That is my impression, which is not does make me happy at all.
And George Mambio, this news is now beginning to spread on the corporate media here in the United States, but what's happening in Britain? Are you having similar battles between the corporate media and the internet?
Well, the corporate media has picked it up pretty well comprehensively, and they have messed it up pretty well comprehensively. The misreporting of this issue is second almost to none that I've ever come across before. They have managed to mix up the use of white phosphorus against military versus civilian targets. For example, repeatedly I'm seeing in the media that it's a war crime if it's used against civilians, but not if it's used against the military. The Chemical Weapons Convention does not mention the word civilian. It does not mention the word non-combatant. There is no distinction made. If you use white phosphorus as a weapon against human beings, that is a war crime. It doesn't matter whether those human beings are civilians. It doesn't matter whether they are military. It remains a war crime. They've mixed up several other things as well. And the result of this is that if we're not careful, we can see excuses made for the use of this weapon as a weapon of war. And the whole point of the Chemical Weapons Convention is to prevent that from recurring. If we look back to the First World War and saw how mustard gas and phosgene were used, and saw in the subsequent commemorations of that war, these lines and lines of men with their hands on each other's shoulders walking along because they could not see, because they had been blinded by this gas or their lungs had been destroyed by this gas, the undermining of the Chemical Weapons Convention threatens to bring about the kind of gas warfare which we saw in the First World War and which we saw in the war between Iran and Iraq. It's absolutely essential that we get this story right and we make it completely impossible for states such as the United States or indeed any other to use poison, toxic chemicals as a weapon of war and to use it ever again.
Well, George Mambio and Maurizio Turrialta, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. And I want to point out, I don't think the military is confused, because when Lieutenant Colonel Boylan, first on Democracy Now!, denied the use of white phosphorus as a weapon, he said as a weapon against people. He didn't say insurgents or civilians. He said we didn't use it against people. So that's an interesting point, and I wish they had joined us today. George Mambio of the Guardian of London and Maurizio Turrialta, news editor for the Italian television, the state broadcaster Rai, co-producer of the film Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Juan?
Well, facing intense criticism from human rights, legal and civil liberties groups, the Senate voted on Tuesday to restore some of the rights of detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. Under the deal worked out by Republican Lindsey Graham and Democrat Carl Levin, detainees convicted by military tribunals can have their cases reviewed by federal courts. Graham sponsored the original amendment, hastily passed by the Senate last Thursday, that stripped detainees of their right to habeas corpus, which is their right to challenge their detention in a federal court. This amendment overturned a June 2004 Supreme Court ruling that had affirmed the detainees' right to habeas corpus. The compromise reached with Levin still reverses the Supreme Court ruling but allows any detainee sentenced to death or at least 10 years in prison by a military tribunal to automatically appeal the decision to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. In addition, the deal restores federal court jurisdiction over pending cases and provides for a court review of whether standards and procedures of the tribunals are consistent with the Constitution.
Senator Graham also linked the legislation with another measure by Arizona Senator John McCain that forbids U.S. troops from torturing or abusing detainees. That measure was overwhelmingly passed by the Senate last month. We'll be discussing this issue with two attorneys who followed this closely. But first, I wanted to play a clip from an interview that I did with Professor Peter Linebaugh when I was in Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, last March. Professor Linebaugh teaches history at University of Toledo and is author of the article, The Secret History of the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta is the English charter signed in 1215 that articulates the right of habeas corpus and is the basis of much of American constitutional law. I began by asking Professor Linebaugh to explain the significance of the Magna Carta.
It still plays a very important part in law against tyranny. For example, last summer in June 2004, when the Supreme Court admitted that the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay should have some kind of judicial hearing, Magna Carta was cited. Or two months ago in December, the House of Lords in England struck down the English equivalent to the Patriot Bill on the grounds of arbitrary arrest, putting people away without a trial or an indictment. And we've seen in England, Ian MacDonald, for example, a barrister, has resigned from any of the kangaroo courts on the grounds that this is a violation of Magna Carta.
I then asked Professor Linebaugh how the Magna Carta relates to the detentions at Guantanamo.
Prohibits torture. And it says that no man, no free man, may be arrested or imprisoned without due process of law and judgment by his or her peers. So you can see already in quoting that chapter, as I've just done, that its provisions are violated in Guantanamo Bay. All four that I cited, there's no jury trial. There's without due process of law, without habeas corpus, and by the exercise of torture. So these are the ways that in Guantanamo Bay it is violated.
So why?
Professor Peter Linebaugh speaking recently in Ann Arbor. When we come back, we'll be joined by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and David Rifkin, a partner at the Washington office of Baker & Hostetler, a visiting fellow at the Nixon Center and contributing editor of the National Review magazine, as well as a member of the UN Subcommission on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights, which is an expert body supporting UN Human Rights Commission. Juan?
Michael, I'd like to begin with you. You're assessment of the compromise that was reached by the Senate on this issue?
Well, we don't like it. I mean, since 1789, and really even since the Magna Carta, 1789 is when the habeas statute was put into our law, there has only been really a suspension of habeas corpus in the Civil War, and since then there really hasn't been. And all of a sudden, really, without hearings, without any kind of real procedures, the Senate now, with a lot of the Democrats, strips out some of the major rights having to do with habeas corpus. And, you know, we at the Center for Constitutional Rights won this case, Razul v. Bush, giving Guantanamo detainees the right to test their detention in a federal court. And what this statute purports to do is to take that right away. The only thing I'll say that's positive about it, maybe, is that Senator Levin went on the floor and said it's only prospective, which gives us a strong argument that it doesn't apply to the current habeas cases we have filed. But look at Juan, it's been 4 years. Our clients have not been charged with the crime, they haven't been convicted of a crime, and they haven't been sentenced. And they have not yet had a hearing in federal court where they can contest why they're in prison. This so-called compromise may give us 2 more years of litigation before we get them what they need.
And David Rifkin, your perspective on the compromise?
I largely share Michael's views. I think that the compromise is better than the original version of the amendment, which would have stripped all of habeas jurisdiction, not just prospectively, but applicable to pending cases, but effectively stripped all the jurisdiction of federal courts to consider cases brought by aliens. Depending on which version you looked at, it would have applied to aliens not only held overseas, but in the United States. I certainly agree that Congress does have a power to suspend habeas corpus. I do not think it would have been justified in this case. Michael is right. It only happened last time in American history during the Civil War. I also think, but to put things in perspective, it is burdensome and difficult for the federal government to litigate literally dozens and dozens and dozens of cases, but I think that's a necessary price you pay. And to me, at least, the existence of a strong habeas process is something that should reassure people who are concerned about possible abuses of executive power. That's the price you have to pay in a democracy for your ability to detain individuals as enemy combatants. And I think every time the courts have upheld the administration's position, and I would say despite the loss in Rousseau, most of the basic propositions involved in the administration's legal paradigm, namely that individuals who are classified as enemy combatants, including U.S. citizens, can be held for the duration of hostilities, that it's not a criminal process, they don't have to be charged, they have to be treated humanely, but can be, as I mentioned, held for a protracted period of time, the courts have upheld it. And I think it's a good thing. Those decisions by the American judiciary legitimate, hopefully, at least in my view, and hopefully in the view of the critics, the executive branch's position. So I think there was a very unfortunate and unnecessary effort.
Michael Ratner.
Well, David, I'm really, you know, it's really good to have you with us on this habeas issue. And it is a fundamental right. It's our protection, really, since the Magna Carta. So I think it's essential, and I was really pleased to see your article speaking out against it. There's still a chance, I hope, to reverse this. It goes into the conference. There's still hope by pushing some of the senators to say, let's get rid of this bad bill. This tinkers with habeas, not just tinkers, but wipes it out for a whole segment of people, particularly people detained at Guantanamo. So I think there's still a good chance we can beat this back because it is a nasty piece of legislation. One point that we have differed on in our various debates, and I still differ with you about, is whether they have actually, the courts have upheld the right to hold enemy combatants indefinitely. What they upheld was really the right in the Hamden case, the Hamdi case, to to keep in prison somebody who had fought in the war in Afghanistan till the end of the duration of that war in Afghanistan. And I don't think they've gone farther to simply say that you can hold the people in Guantanamo forever based on being enemy combatants. That's a point that you and I differ upon, but I'm glad to say that we agree on the nastiness of this legislation in the Senate.
And I would just add, also, technically, it is utterly confusing. It's not clear. It applies to prospective cases. I would hate to see the spectacle of another 2 years spending litigating what is the true meaning of this legislation. I don't see how it helps anybody. It doesn't help people who want to contest their detention, to which they're fully entitled, nor does it help the administration that wants to lessen the burden of dealing with hundreds of cases and wants to actually move forward with military commission proceedings. This is a solution in search of a problem.
I agree with you, David, that what should be clarified here is, first of all, I think it should be stripped out altogether. We should just get rid of this piece of legislation. But at a minimum, it should say that it doesn't apply to current people litigating cases around Guantanamo, which is what Senator Levin says and which we think is right.
Isn't this the administration's worst nightmare, why we're seeing President Bush, Vice President Cheney really hitting hard on the issue of people criticizing the administration? I mean, here we have Michael Ratner, head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and David Rifkin, who worked for Reagan, who worked for George H.W. Bush, writes for the National Review magazine. David Rifkin, what about this comment? Have you seen this in the 20 years from the time of Reagan, really a quarter of a century ago, to now, this unanimity that we're beginning to see now against the administration policies?
Well, to be clear, Michael and I share the view that the jurisdiction stripping, the habeas imperium provision is a bad thing. There are a number of other aspects of administration's policy that I think are more deserving of support. My concern, however, with this whole effort, and I think Michael mentioned it earlier, is the process effort. Look, for a long time, I've been of a view that the executive branch would have been well advised early after September 11 to work together with Congress in coming up with a comprehensive legislation addressing issues relating to treatment, detention, interrogation of enemy combatants, have serious hearings, have a serious national debate, and come up with a joint solution by both political branches. Unfortunately, it has not happened. Now, Congress is being involved. How are they being involved? It's being done in a typical Washington fashion as amendments to defense authorization bill, with language switching literally overnight, without serious hearings. Michael probably likes the McCain amendment, but I would say one thing about McCain amendment, that's the one you mentioned earlier, dealing with the issue of inhumane and degrading treatment. Whatever you think about the merits of a McCain amendment, I would submit to you, the language of it is entirely confusing. I read the thing three times, and I talked to a number of colleagues in the administration and even among congressional staffers. It's not clear whether McCain means to suggest that the 5th, 8th, and the 14th Amendment applies overseas or does not, which is a fundamentally a different issue from level of treatment, because if those amendments do apply overseas, which they never held to apply, under the 14th Amendment, which incorporates other amendments in the Bill of Rights, enemy combatants held overseas would have right to a lawyer to be present during all interrogations. I very much doubt that even Senator McCain would be willing to go that far. But what we're going to have if this thing passes is the next 3 years of litigation about what exactly this thing means. That's not very responsible. We should be able to do a better job dealing with those difficult issues.
Michael, your response?
Well, I think the McCain Amendment is obviously crucial to me. It bans cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. I think that's already been banned. I think Gonzalez's interpretation of the Convention Against Torture, saying we can somehow use those techniques against non-citizens, was a really poor legal interpretation that I would have flunked any first-year law student for writing. And I think in terms of the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendment, what McCain is saying, what the Convention Against Torture says, is really the substance of what those prohibitions are applies, not that the amendments directly apply. I will agree with David that the way this has been done in Congress, particularly the stripping of habeas, was like something I've never seen. I mean, there were no hearings. There was a bunch of senators puffed up getting up in front of Congress. I thought I was looking at the Roman Forum. They could have been wearing togas, you know, just talking about how, you know, a series of lies about what this litigation has represented, that it wasn't really about people's freedom, that it was about what kind of CDs they could get. And that's just bull.
But Michael, given the enormous dissatisfaction that members of Congress have evinced in recent weeks with the conduct of the war in Iraq, with questions of torture by American forces, with this whole issue of the secret detention facilities of the CIA. Isn't it surprising that yet you find on both the Patriot Act and on this compromise that Congress seems to be willing to go right ahead with the administration's policies?
And on Iraq, I should say, as well, a reporting requirement. And you and I have lived through that stuff in the El Salvador and Vietnam, where all you got was Congress continuously reporting, and not actually telling the president anything about what really to do. So until there's a lot more public pressure here, Juan, on each of these issues, on torture, on habeas, and on the war, you're going to see the congressmen essentially wrapping themselves in the flag and making, I think, very mild criticisms.
There's a piece in the Chicago Sun-Times. The United States has detained over 83,000 foreigners in the 4 years of the war on terror, enough to nearly fill the NFL's largest stadium. The administration defends the practice of holding detainees in prisons from Afghanistan to Guantanamo Bay as a critical tool to stop the insurgency in Iraq, maintain stability in Afghanistan, and get suspected terrorists off the streets. Roughly 14,500 detainees remain in U.S. custody, primarily in Iraq. The number has steadily grown since CIA officers touched down in Afghanistan in 2001. 83,000 foreigners, enough to fill the NFL's largest stadium. I wanted to go to the issue of what the U.S. calls rendition. Others call it kidnapping. But now increasing international opposition to countries when people in their countries learn about the use of their airfields to take prisoners that are kidnapped off the street from one country to another, and these secret CIA bases that Juan referred to.
Well, it's good to see this kind of opposition finally building up in these countries. We've had the indictments, of course, in Italy, where 13 CIA people have been indicted and their extradition has been asked for from the United States for kidnapping an Egyptian cleric and sending him to Egypt. You just saw recently in Spain, where now people are saying that the Spanish airport, I think the one in Mallorca, was actually used for these rendition planes. You've seen this in Sweden. So there's growing opposition to using airports in Europe right now for rendering people to other countries where they are tortured, or to CIA places where they're tortured. It's just the beginning. The center has, as you know, the one case, Maher Arar, who was sent from the United States, actually, to Syria. We're litigating that. The administration is fighting against it. But this is it's like a huge hidden elephant, because what we are doing is taking people from anywhere in the world and sending them to torture chambers. And one of the things they're afraid of in the McCain Amendment is that they won't be able to continue to torture people when they get them in these CIA hell holes.
David Rifkin, what about this issue of these secret detention facilities abroad?
Well, let me just say one thing briefly. I agree with Michael that it is absolutely unacceptable to send people to be tortured by third parties. We have to be careful, however, not to extrapolate from that the broader proposition that we should not send anybody anywhere. Because, look, the only way we can win in this war is to do that in a multilateral context, cooperating at the military, intelligence, and economic level. I personally would not be comfortable sending anybody to Syria. Whether or not I would be prepared to send people to Jordan, is it for a country like Jordan, for example, or a country like Morocco, is a different story. Both are not exactly Jeffersonian democracies, but have better track records than it comes to dealing with prisoners, especially if we obtain adequate assurances. So all I'm saying is we cannot be absolutist about it, because, I mean, otherwise we'd get in a situation where everybody would say Americans, once again, are being unilateral. So Syria and countries like that are probably in a different basket. I wouldn't send people to Iran. I certainly wouldn't send people to North Korea.
That note, David Rifkin, we have to leave it there. David Rifkin, a partner at Baker and Hostetler, visiting fellow at the Nixon Center, worked under the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, and Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. By the way, Juan will not be with us tomorrow. He's speaking at the FCC Consumer Advisory Committee at a media ownership panel in Washington, D.C., 11 to noon Eastern Standard Time. At democracynow.org, we'll provide a video stream of that event. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. You can go to our website at democracynow.org and sign up for our daily headlines. Images, video, photographs, audio are all available at democracynow.org, where we also podcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!